Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer, director of the Pacifica Radio Archives, and welcome to From the Vault. This week, we enter the centuries-old debate between science and religion as we present two historic 1959 recordings on the occasion of the 100th anniversary of the publication of Charles Darwin's seminal work on evolution, On the Origins of Species. This work, published in 1859, established evolution as the dominant scientific explanation for the diversity in nature. Beginning in the early 1950s, the American scientific community began planning the Darwin Centennial Celebration. The effort resulted in a five-day event beginning November 24, 1959, and was held at the University of Chicago. It featured lectures and panel discussions with prominent scholars on the subject, including Darwin's grandson, Sir Charles Darwin. Pacifica station KPFA was present to record one of the other notable participants, Sir Julian Huxley, who gave this address a few weeks later at the Monterey Peninsula College on December 18, 1959. He begins by reflecting on the centennial celebration events held in Chicago.
I have been interested in evolution, I was going to say all my life, that's perhaps an exaggeration, but ever since I was a boy at school. And it has been my privilege these last months to be asked by the University of Chicago to help them prepare and to take part in their great Darwin centennial celebrations. And this has taught me a great deal and has helped to clarify what I call the evolutionary vision, clarify the sight of the vision of the world which was first opened to our sight by the genius of Darwin. Now, this centennial was a very remarkable phenomenon. Perhaps future historians of human thought will take the centennial at Chicago as epitomizing an important critical period in the history of this earth. The period when, to put it epigrammatically, the process of evolution in the person of inquiring man began to be truly conscious of itself. For this period, this week was, as far as I'm aware, the first time when authorities on the evolutionary aspects of the three great branches of scientific study, the inorganic sciences, the life sciences, and the human sciences, were brought together for mutual criticism and joint discussion. The participants were assembled from all parts of the globe, and they included representatives of astronomy and physics and chemistry, of zoology, botany and physiology and paleontology, of ecology and ethology, psychology and anthropology and the social sciences. And all of us there were asked to contribute some account of our knowledge to the common pool, or some of our understanding of evolution, to the common pool of the centennial, and then to submit our contributions to the criticism and comments of our fellow participants, often in quite other fields, to engage in public discussion. There were five big public panel discussions in the presence of a large audience, a discussion of key points in evolutionary theory, and then to have the discussions and our contributions published to the world at large. I'm sure that this was one of the first public occasions on which it was frankly faced that all aspects of reality are subject to evolution, from atoms and stars to fish and flowers, and from fish and flowers up to man's societies and religions. Well, indeed, that the whole of reality is a single process of evolution. And this period is the first in which man has acquired sufficient knowledge to see the outline of this vast process as a home. As I say, I'd always been interested in evolution, but I certainly learnt a great deal myself from this centennial meeting of minds. For instance, it confirmed me by my contact with the anthropologists and social scientists there, confirmed me in the certainty that evolution is going on in man, but that it proceeds not by the same methods as biological evolution, but by quite different methods and with quite different results. I'll come back to that later. Then a point which a number of us had been getting to, which got confirmed by the centennial, namely that all visible effects, all results in evolution, all characters of animals and plants, and or indeed all cultural characters of man, are in a certain sense compromises. They are the result of a balance between different needs. That if you push anything to its too logical conclusion, it'll be a failure. Thirdly, that though this has often been questioned by ultra-skeptical minds, that something you must call advance or progress does occur in evolution. It isn't both in human evolution and in biological evolution. It isn't inevitable, and it doesn't always happen in a straight line. But it does occur. And that when it does occur, it occurs by passing from one step or grade to another, one step or grade of organization. And that each step means stepping to a new pattern of organization. In biology, the pattern is of organization of the animal or plant structure and physiology and behavior. In man, it is an organization of ideas and beliefs and so on, imposed on a pattern of social structure and way of life. Again, I'll come back to that. And finally, there was a good deal of discussion of the what you might call the general or philosophical bearings of the idea of evolution. And this again made it quite clear that we are now in the process. We are at the beginning here in this world in the mid-20th century. We are at the beginning of the passage from one grade of ideological organization to another. We are gradually learning to leave behind, to step up from the old idea system prevalent for several centuries, which was partly supernaturalist and what I may call God-centered, and was partly static and mechanistic, thought that the world was a great mechanism, a sort of clockwork mechanism set going by a creator many, many years ago. And getting away from the idea of a system focused on ideas of law, and in both its religious and its scientific aspects, essentially static. Also, in many ways, backward-looking and traditional, and in a sense, authoritarian. And based always on the idea of competition between political systems or religious systems or ideological systems, economic systems, and so on. And stepping up to a different type of organization, which was not dualistic, but monistic, was based on a single approach, and was naturalistic in that it took the whole of existence as its province and didn't think that there was anything supernatural in the ordinary sense. And it such a system which looks on all the facts of experience, including human values, including religions and so on, as natural phenomena which are capable of being studied and understood in the same sort of way as we can study and understand other phenomena by human reason and scientific method. And furthermore, in place of a competitive type of approach, we are being forced to adopt a global, a unitary form of approach in which we think of what's happening to man as a whole. And finally, and this is where the evolutionary side comes in, where we're giving up the idea of a static mechanism, something laid down once and for all in the past, in favor of a process, in favor of everything being a process of evolution in which more or less unpredictable novelties emerge in the course of time. Novelties and higher degrees of organization. And the whole process, the whole approach, focused on man as the present spearhead, if I may say so, of the evolutionary process on this planet. And therefore, primarily forward-looking instead of backward-looking. And though based on the authority, if you like to call it, of firmly established knowledge, yet frankly realizing that knowledge is always incomplete and that we shall be constantly adding to our knowledge and also formulating our factual knowledge in different conceptual ways. And I would call such an approach, my personal word for it, is evolutionary humanism. Now, if I may go back for a moment to the biological process of evolution. First of all, I would say that it seems clear that though evolution is, as I say, the whole of reality is in a sense evolution, yet the vast overall process falls into three very distinct phases or sectors: the inorganic one, the evolution of atoms and elements of stars and nebulae, then the biological sector, which works by quite different methods, works by natural selection, and leads to quite different results, a sector of life. And finally, the human, or as more accurately called, the psychosocial sector, which is confined to the evolution of man. That's all we know. There may be other similar psychosocial evolutions going on other planets. We don't know about them. And this, again, operates by new mechanisms, we'll come back to that later, and operates much more quickly and produces all sorts of quite different results. Whereas biological evolution has produced very extraordinary organisms like flying fish and hummingbirds and orchids and so on. It has not produced what human or psychosocial evolution has, namely works of art and systems of law and religions. It's quite new types of products.
You are listening to our Darwin Centennial recordings from 1959 on From the Vault. For a copy of this program or to browse the other programs in our series, visit us online at fromthevaultradio.org or call us in the archives at 1-800-735-0230.
Haven't you ever heard of Darwin? Did you think we were gonna run and hide? Haven't you ever heard of Darwin? Don't roll down your car windows. It's a jungle outside.
And now back to our program. In this next recording, we have Sir Julian Huxley's famous brother Aldous Huxley, who's best known for authoring the book Brave New World, moderating a Darwin Centennial panel on the impact of Darwin's theories in the modern world. Remember, this was 1959. The panel includes Dr. George Beadle, Garrett Hardin, and James Walter. Our records show that this event took place on October 23, 1959, but that was a month before the centennial events held at the University of Chicago. We would like to encourage our history detectives out there in our listening audience to help us solve this history mystery. To join the investigation of this mystery, join us on our Facebook group page, Friends of the Pacifica Radio Archives.
Ladies and gentlemen, I am called the moderator. I don't exactly know what I have to moderate, whether it's the fury of Santa Barbara against Caltech or the bitter internecine feuds between different schools of biology. Actually, I would imagine that everybody here at this table is more or less agreed is in agreement with what Dr. Beadle said in his lectures, and we shall, I think, simply discuss a number of the endless points which naturally arise when you start discussing evolution. But what I wanted to start with was a question of fact. What Dr. Beadle was telling us yesterday, above all, was mainly about discoveries which have occurred really within the last 6 years. I mean, these fundamental discoveries about the matter which replicates itself and the possibility of reproducing this by synthetic means. And I would like to know, I think Dr. Hardin would be able to tell us, to what extent did Darwin anticipate this kind of thing? I mean, how far was it possible in his days, 900 years ago, to foresee the kind of things which we were going to discover now?
Well, the amazing thing about this is, and I might say that we were talking about this a little bit before because someone had handed in a question that put this in mind. The amazing thing is that Darwin went farther than he should have been able to go because the state of knowledge of the necessary chemistry then wasn't very well advanced. And yet, once somebody brought up the question to him about the problem of the origin of life and whether life could have originated from non-living molecules, or whether this was just ridiculous. And he replied in this way: "It is often said that all the conditions for the first production of a living organism are now present, which could ever have been present. But if, and oh what a big if, we could conceive in some warm little pond with all sorts of ammonia and phosphoric salts, light, heat, electricity, and so forth present, that a protein compound was chemically formed ready to undergo still more complex changes. At the present day, such matter would be instantly devoured or absorbed, which would not have been the case before living creatures were formed." Now, this was written in 1871, and the amazing thing is that it wasn't until the late 1920s that exactly the same argument was put forward again by J.B.S. Haldane, and then in the 30s by Russian Oparin, I don't know if that's pronounced right, both of these men not knowing that they had been preceded by Darwin, who had just seen through the logic of the situation very simply. In other words, he suggested, and it's interesting to notice that he put the right things in it: ammonia, phosphoric salts, and electricity. Well, that isn't quite all. He didn't mention carbon dioxide. But since it was a pond, there certainly was water. And this is what Miller's student, Urey, did just a few years ago. Shot electricity through water containing these things and got some organic compounds. Now, of course, step from that to living things is quite a step, but you see, Darwin saw the second part of the problem in that he said that before there was any life, such material could have accumulated. And so, even granting that it might be an improbable thing that non-living organic compounds could evolve to some sort of self-reproductive organic compounds, even granting that it's improbable, there would have been a lot of time because these things would have accumulated. And I think it's awfully keen insight back in 1871.
It sounds almost as if Darwin should have got the Nobel Prize for inventing biochemical genetics instead of Beadle.
That's right. Are you going to give yours up to him?
quite well. I spent the money, but the metal ones are.
I see. Okay.
Be worth pointing out at this stage that Darwin came extremely close to inventing genetics, too. He made some hybridizations in snapdragons, which, had he only recognized it, produced a perfect Mendelian ratio. So remarkable as Darwin's achievements were, he came very close to doing a good deal more. One wonders if there's any end to this. One could keep on discovering unknown Darwin papers.
Now, let's start with the first of your questions. I see you have a huge pile of them here.
We have an embarrassment of riches, and there are several that bear on one field here that if I can just paraphrase rather than read any one of them, the questions, and it's not surprising that there are several because we know that there's quite a popular area of interest here in the genetic effects of radiation. And if I can paraphrase several questions combined, it would, the question I think would go like this, that since radiation produces mutations, and since we know that mutations are important in producing evolution as the raw material of evolution, then why all this worry about radiation? Isn't it good to have some radiation around to produce the kinds of mutations that can start off the evolutionary process? Toss this one to Professor Beadle.
Yes. This is an interesting question, and it's perfectly true that radiation, high energy radiation to the germline, does increase mutation frequency, and as far as we know, it increases all kinds of mutations, the good ones and the unfavorable ones. So therefore it follows that if you double the mutation rate, you will double the number of favorable mutations, and therefore why isn't this good? Well, the answer to this is extremely simple. In the first place, only a small fraction of the total are favorable. Perhaps less than 1% are favorable mutations. The unfavorable ones must be eliminated by natural selection. And natural selection, a more dramatic term for elimination by natural selection, has been given by Muller, genetic death. This doesn't mean that an individual has to die literally. It means an individual doesn't reproduce at the normal rate. I'm 90% genetically dead if I only have 1/10 my share of children, statistically. That is my line of descent. If a person may die genetically by not having any children at all. This is the same as not being here as far as the next generation is concerned. Well, one can summarize very quickly by saying that for every deleterious mutation in a stable population, there must be a compensating genetic death. Therefore, if you double the number of total mutations, you will double the number of genetic deaths, which will be the price you'll pay for doubling the favorable mutations. Now, in our population, the number of individuals born with significant genetic defects is about 2%, about 2 per 100. If you doubled the total number of mutations at equilibrium, this would go to 4%. There would be 4% of individuals with some sort of genetic disease. This would be the price you'd pay, society would pay, for doubling the favorable mutations. And if you were willing to do this, if society were willing to do this, you could double the number of favorable mutations. But this wouldn't do any good in present society for the following reason. We have plenty of favored individuals genetically, and we do not encourage their differential reproduction. And unless we do this, we're not making use of the ones we have. If we're not making use of the favorable genetic combinations we already have, it doesn't do any good to have any more. Well, you can say, let's change society so that we do make use of them. Well, if we did make use of them, we'd already have plenty to make use of. We wouldn't need any more. Let's assume that we made use of all we have and we ran out of all the good ones and needed some more. Then we could make some more with radiation. The only difficulty now is that you wouldn't be able to detect them in most cases. Let's say we want to produce mutations that increase intelligence by 10%. if you increased the intelligence of an average person by 10%, it would still be within the normal range, and you couldn't pick them up to preferentially replicate them, even if you could do it. So it wouldn't do you any good to have more mutations produced as a result of increasing the total mutation frequency. You would have to pay the price and get no benefit.
What you were saying is a partial answer to another of the questions you had about to what extent can man be the master of his own evolutionary destiny. I forget the exact wording of it. I think you have it there.
I think you put it better than the question did. If I have to shuffle many papers here to find
yes.
it, but I think this the general gist of the question is just that. To what Dr. Beadle spoke last night of man's ability to control evolution, and at least what I understood him to say was to control evolution of other things than himself, in, for example, domesticated animals and plants. But this apparently stimulated a question in the mind of one of the listeners as to the possibility of our controlling our own evolution. And shall we address ourselves to that a bit?
I think Dr. Huxley, as author of Brave New World, ought to speak to that particular question.
Of course, in Brave New World, there were rather special conditions. I mean, they had solved the problem producing babies in bottles, which simplified everything to a very large extent. And also, they were not at all loath to produce changes in the embryos which would create the lower ranks of the scientific caste system. But of course, more seriously, we have to consider the possibilities of eugenics. I mean, the idea has been before us, I mean, ever since the time of Galton, I suppose the last 50 or 60 years. And remarkably little progress has been made. I mean, and I think you have indicated one of the reasons why this is unlikely to be increased. I mean, until we reach the idea that we must make the best of the resources which we have at present, and to what extent we shall run up against enormous psychological and ideological barriers towards this, I don't know.
And that does it for this week's edition of From the Vault. Join our Facebook group, Friends of the Pacific Radio Archives. This program was produced by Mark Torres and Brian DeShazer. The series is executive produced by the Pacifica Radio Archives and your host, Brian DeShazer.